This week on Making Contact.
My family will never be able to go back and live on our land.
We're not really interested in the psyche of the people in Gaza. All we're concerned about is the safety and the security of our citizens in Israel.
The Israelis are not working to let the Arabs feel that they should be wanted in the area.
It seems like a conflict that may never end. Israelis and Palestinians are fighting again. This week, we look back at the history of the occupation of Palestine. We'll hear from several Palestinians about how they've personally been affected, and we get the Israeli government's perspective on the current situation as we begin 2009. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Conflicts in the land known as Palestine have been going on for more than 2,000 years. But is there a point at which we can mark the beginning of the modern resistance? Palestinian opposition to colonial rule began long before the mainstream media highlighted rock-throwing teenagers in the late 1980s, and the enemy hasn't always been the Israeli army. From the Making Contact archives, producer Shireen Marisol Meraji takes us on a journey through the history of the modern Palestinian resistance. We start by hearing from Hatem Bazyan, a lecturer at the Department of Near Eastern and Ethnic Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. In May of 2002, in San Francisco, Bazyan gave a talk on the history of Palestinian resistance.
Napoleon attacked Palestine after he invaded Egypt in 1798. In 1799, he took his campaign to Palestine because he wanted to conquer the Palestinian coastal line up to Lebanon and then come back and consolidate his forces in, throughout the area of the heartland of the Arab world. He actually takes over Gaza, he goes up to the Ramleh, to the Lid, and then he actually lay a siege on the city of Akka in the northern part of Palestine. And they could not break the fortification of Gaza and to be able to break the Palestinians. And Napoleon lost 3,500 soldiers in the siege of Akka. He withdrew his troops and went back to Egypt, knowing that Akka actually is the city in his plan for the conquering of the coastal areas of the Mediterranean in competition with the British. Even in 1876, the British and the French and the German wanted to have consular offices opened in the city of Jerusalem. And the Palestinians refused and had a petition that was sent out to the Ottoman Porte in Istanbul, asking the Ottoman to refuse to allow the French, British, and the German to open consular offices in Jerusalem. The Porte in Istanbul accepted the petition of the Palestinians and did not allow these consulates to be opened in the city of Jerusalem. And here we need to understand the dynamics that takes place in relations to Western powers and how they really systematically wanted to penetrate the Near East for their own designs. Most of it is really to undermine the structural societies, and they really worked to undermine the economic structure by opening banks in the coastal area of Palestine that essentially had the vision of trying to establish a Jewish homeland even at that early stage. Also in 1882, we have also a massive protest in Jerusalem and in the heartland of Palestinian areas against further concessions given to Jewish immigrants who were beginning to set up settlements, because the first settlement in Palestine began in 1876. And the Palestinians at that time also were protesting the opening of these settlements because they saw it as a continuation and a beginning of an extension of European powers trying to extend their influence in there. What I'm pointing out that the Palestinians knew who they are early on and knew themselves in relations to the power structure. And they also were resisting the Ottomans. And this is also something that people need to know, that we had a number of rebellions against the Ottoman authority, and people don't resist and have rebellions unless they have an identity, they have their own identity and understand who they are, and they have a history that reflects their tradition and their culture and their political aspirations.
Bazian added that the Balfour Declaration of 1917 was another major blow to Palestinian autonomy. In the declaration, British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour, on behalf of the British government, wrote an official letter stating Britain's, quote, sympathy with Zionist aspirations, unquote, and their willingness to establish a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. By 1936, there was an increase in Jewish immigration and land acquisition, which led to the three-year Palestinian revolt. Hatem Bazian.
Palestinians resisted also throughout the 20th century. In 1936, we had the major resistance that took place as a result of what? The shifting of land, once again, from the Palestinian peasants who were actually either sharecroppers or actually employees for generations in these massive agricultural lands. The lands were sold either by the British in some structures or by absentee Arabs in Lebanon, or some Arabs who inside Palestine who actually conspired against the Palestinians, being paid higher price by the British, while the British were actually transferring the land to the Jewish settlers. And in 1935, we have 240,000 acre of land being shifted from the Palestinian sharecroppers, from the peasants who were worked these lands for generations, shifted to the Zionists, and that was a major cause for the rebellion in 1936. Once again, if you look, it is land that is at the heart of the issue. It is the land that the Palestinians were living in being shifted and given to a new immigrant population. Now, I know my time, I can't go through, but the resistance continuously is there. It's shifting land from the Palestinians' hands to a new immigrant population that is being superimposed over them. And if I leave you with this, just know that the Palestinians will resist. This is as just as the fact that you get up in the morning and eat breakfast, the Palestinians will resist. That's our history, that we will not accept any occupation, no matter what the power that is supporting it. And this is another thing that people think, that because the United States is supporting Israel, somehow that the Palestinians are going to give up. We're going to be liberated despite U.S. continued support of Israel, and this is what people need to realize.
The State of Israel was officially established on May 14, 1948, in Tel Aviv. In August of 1947, the United Nations proposed dividing the land into a Jewish state and an Arab state, with a small international zone. Arabs rejected the plan. At the start of 1948, Jewish and Arab military staged attacks, but the Jewish forces were increasingly successful, not only in seizing areas allotted for the Jewish state, but conquering substantial lands allocated to the Palestinians. On April 9, 1948, near Jerusalem, Jewish militant forces massacred hundreds of Palestinian civilians in the village of Deir Yassin. Word of the massacre spread terror, and nearly 800,000 Palestinians fled to Lebanon, Egypt, and the West Bank in order to save the lives of their families.
For example, my family's land, which we have the deeds for and the keys to our houses, was confiscated in 1948.
Nadia Shana is a Palestinian-American who lives in Washington, D.C. She spoke with Making Contact at a rally calling for an end to the Israeli occupation.
We had a lot of land, my family did. We were like the rich of the poor. We had no money, but we had land. So I know my father died now, but my family will never be able to go back and live on our land.
In 1967, a fierce battle ensued between Israel and its Arab neighbors. This war dramatically changed the face of the Middle East conflict. Israel doubled its land mass and displaced 500,000 more Palestinians, killing hundreds in the process. Israel forcibly occupied the areas of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and the Golan Heights. Mohsen Agha is a Palestinian from Gaza who was not allowed to return to his land after the 1967 war. He spoke with Making Contact's Laura Levati at a Palestinian solidarity rally in Washington, D.C.
Basically, I'm from Gaza Strip, and since 1967, the war of 1967, I was outside the country, and since then, I wasn't able to go back. And still, my mother there, my father, when my father died, I wasn't able to go and see him before he was buried. Before the war, I was in Egypt for my high education, and in June 67, the war happened, and since then they considered me as, they say that I can't go back to the country because I wasn't there during the war, I mean before the war.
Who is the they that said you could not go back?
The Israeli government.
Asad Abu Khalil is a research fellow at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies and the author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. He says that the notion of the right of return is at the heart of the Palestinian resistance movement.
In 1950, Israel created the law of return. It basically said, if you are a Jewish person anywhere around the world, you can go to Israel and become a citizen. No questions asked. And yet the Palestinians who were kicked out of their homes, who have deeds to the house and to the land, keys to the house from which they were evicted, will never be allowed to go back. The right of return is basically stipulated by a United Nations Security Council, says that those refugees are the responsibility of Israel and that they should be allowed to return or compensated. Most Palestinians insist on the right to return because they don't want to stay citizens of Lebanon or Syria. They feel they're Palestinians and they feel they have the right to go back. And as long as Jewish citizens of the world have the right to go that land and claim it for themselves, and the Palestinians who've been there for centuries cannot go back, Israel will be seen as a racist state. This is one of the crux of the dilemmas of the Arab-Israeli question.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to Palestine, Perspectives on the Occupation. In December of 2008, violence in Palestine escalated once again with an Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government says the operation was a response to continued rocket fire from Hamas. Hamas is considered a terrorist group by Israel and the United States, but is also the elected leadership of Palestine. At the time this program was produced, more than 700 Palestinians had been killed, along with 11 Israelis. Jeff Berg of radio station KPFT in Houston spoke with Asher Yardan, the U.S. Southwest Consul General for Israel, to get the Israeli government's perspective on this issue and to have him respond to criticisms coming from much of the world.
Mr. Yardan serves the government of Israel as a diplomat representing the state of Israel to Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and New Mexico, based here in Houston. Let's really get to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is that there's been a great deal of criticism about the amount of civilian deaths that have been caused by Israeli airstrikes, Israeli artillery, or other Israeli attacks of whatever kind in the Gaza Strip. And there are a very large and very regrettable number of civilians who have been killed due to Israeli strikes. How does this end? How does this lead to peace? The embitterment of Palestinians, the killing of Palestinians, the killing of Israelis, the back and forth, the war. How does this possibly lead to peace? How does this... Israel wants security, wants the shelling of its southern cities to stop, maybe wants to topple the Hamas government. I've seen that quote around a couple of places. How does this action lead to that?
You know that Israel has shown restraint for over 7 years since Israel pulled out of Gaza. That's something that most people either are not aware or people don't want to know. But in the summer of 2005, Israel pulled out of Gaza unilaterally, destroying all of the Israeli settlements there and gave the Palestinian Authority an opportunity for self-rule, gave the Palestinian Authority an opportunity to move forward towards peace. How was it reciprocated with Hamas leadership, with Hamas taking over in early 06, and with more and more terror, with more and more firing of rockets and of mortar shells against Israel? This is not a reality which any government could agree to. Try to think of the United States. Try to think of American cities being bombarded day after day, with children going to school, with people going to their workplaces. And this is something that the Israeli government, after more than 7 years, decided to stop. Enough is enough. That's pretty much what we said, and that's what we're witnessing right now.
Yeah. The Palestinians, including the Palestinian Authority, says that Israel, in fact, didn't end its occupation of Gaza, that while settlements were uprooted and soldiers actually left, that the checkpoints have all been closed by Israel, that Israel still controls the air and the sea around Gaza, doesn't allow whatever goods or materials or travel the Palestinians wish to flow back and forth between the Gaza Strip and the outside world. Essentially, the Palestinian Authority says that Israel has turned Gaza into a prison, and that while there are no settlers living in the Gaza Strip and while there are no Israeli soldiers physically in the Gaza Strip, Israel controls the air, Israel controls the water, Israel controls the borders, and has effectively created an occupation that chokes the life out of Gaza.
You know, Israel is doing what every sovereign nation is doing. Israel is keeping its borders. The border between Israel and the Gaza Strip is very well kept by Israel, because unfortunately, from the other side, you know, we don't have countries like Switzerland or even Canada or Mexico. We have a very hostile entity. We have a very hostile entity named Hamas, which unfortunately uses the Gaza Strip as a platform for terror actions. And we're trying to put an end to these terror actions so far very successfully, and we'll carry on with this operation until we succeed.
This is the New Capital Show. Jeff Berg sitting in for Leo Gold. Quite frankly, the people of Gaza are suffering. The people of southern Israel are suffering. There is war going on between Israel and Hamas. Israel is conducting a military campaign in what is one of the most, if not the most, densely populated pieces of land on the face of the earth. Invariably, civilians are going to be killed. We have a whole slew of people who obviously believe that Israel is intentionally killing civilians. But even if you take the Israeli point of view and you know that Israel is targeting only Hamas or targeting only Islamic Jihad or only the infrastructure of war-making capability from Gaza, does Israel really expect that at the end of this operation, whenever that is, that at the end of this, there's going to be no violence coming from Gaza directed at Israel? Does Israel think that after it crushes Hamas, the people of Gaza will gladly join hands with their Israeli brothers and sisters across the border and say, you know what, we've learned the error of our ways, we're not going to attack anymore?
The truth of the matter, Jeff, is that we're not really interested in the psyche of the people in Gaza. All we're concerned about is the safety and the security of our people, of our citizens in Israel. That's the purpose and that's the objective of this operation, which is now being held in Gaza.
All right, you're listening to the New Capital Show on KPFT. We are speaking with Asher Yarden, the Israeli Consul General to the Southwest. Since not everyone is briefed on the entire background, in 1967, there was an Arab-Israeli war, the consequence of which was that Israel came into possession of, among other territories, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. Everyone knows that a reasonable solution will include the establishment of a Palestinian state, a viable democratic Palestine on the West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem as its capital. This is what the world wants, and this is what's in everyone's interest. The point really is, just do it. Stop the war and let it happen. What's your response?
We're on the same page. That's what Israel's position has been for several years right now. And we're calling for the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. And that's what we've been trying to negotiate with the Palestinian leadership, not the Hamas leadership, the Fatah leadership, for several years right now. A two-state solution is actually the only viable solution for the conflict, and that's very clear to anybody who knows the area, anybody who knows the history of the conflict. However, obviously, we cannot negotiate anything like this with the Hamas terror organization. The destruction of Israel is the prime objective of this organization. We are willing to withdraw from the vast majority of the territories we gained in the 1967 war. We made it clear. There are certain things that will have to be worked out, of course, and there are many details which are very complicated. But the premise of a two-state solution is very clear, and we made it, repeated it so many times. I think that is a great opportunity to say it once more here at KPFT.
That was Jeff Berg of KPFT Radio in Houston speaking with Asher Yardan, the U.S. Southwest Consul General for Israel. The question of violence permeates discussion about the conflict in Israel and Palestine. Does Israel's invasion of the Gaza Strip create more problems than it solves? And in a country with no army, can a Palestinian political group advocate violence without being labeled as terrorists? The Palestinian Islamic Jihad was labeled a terrorist group by the U.S. government in the late 1990s, and it's the group which Sami Hammoudi was accused of supporting in a case that was supposed to be one of the first major accomplishments of the USA Patriot Act. Hammoudi was one of four Palestinian academics living in Florida for years who were arrested in Tampa in 2003. They were accused of financially supporting the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. University of South Florida professor Sami Al-Aryan is the most famous of the four. After being held in high-security prisons for more than 2 years, a jury returned no guilty verdicts against the four men. Although Sami Hammoudi was cleared of all charges, he had agreed before the trial to be deported, and he returned with his family to the West Bank in May of 2006. He's now teaching political science and anthropology at Beerzit University. In November of 2006, I visited Sami Hammoudi in his home in Ramallah to speak with him about the Palestinian struggle and his ideas for a peaceful solution. I asked Hammoudi what he thought of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and groups like it, which are willing to commit violence to achieve statehood.
Well, I think it's like any other Palestinian organization. They think that they are defending their country, they are defending their people. I do agree with the idea of resistance, that you have to resist, but I don't agree with the methods they use for resistance. I wouldn't approve the killing of innocent people, regardless of the religion of these people or the nationality of these people. Being Israelis, Americans, Arabs, Palestinians, I don't care. But you cannot kill innocent people, people in the streets, people in the buses. I mean, it's not something that you can justify or you can defend. This wouldn't help. Wouldn't help the Palestinians to get at least a Palestinian state within the 22% of the historical Palestine, which is the West Bank.
Did you consider yourself a political activist?
No, not really. I consider myself as not a historian, but someone who likes to write about the history of Palestine, or a historian under training. Because I wrote several books about the history of Palestine, and I'm still working on that. I'm collecting documents to see exactly what was going on, and trying to figure out the pattern of history, how things develop. And my experience in the United States, how people from different nationalities, different religions, can live together, can establish and enhance a feeling of one nation, despite their differences, gives me the opportunity to theorize about a cultural solution for the Palestinian question, which goes far beyond the Zionist theory. Because I think there is a basic problem in Zionism itself. Because it's promising the Jews of something, but it's not achieving it for them. Even the idea of a Jewish state is not working, it's not functioning. Because you are having a state that is an enemy for all of the surroundings, an enemy for everybody in the area.
Yeah.
Such state cannot live.
I mean, you can be with a better military equipment for 100 years, and then after that, can you control the whole Arab area? Can you control Iran, Syria, and every single country from getting weapons that may threaten you? No. You have to establish a good neighborhood between you and your neighbors. Not trying always to equip yourself with weapons, threatening them, letting them feel that you are unwanted. The Israelis are not working towards the other way, to let the Arabs feel that they should be wanted in the area, that they have some kind of experience, they have some kind of a civilized way of living, that they can solve problems in the Middle East. No, they are not introducing themselves this way. They always introduce themselves as people who kill, people who have airplanes that can bomb, that can throw millions of bombs and kill innocent people, threaten the life of everybody. That's how they introduce themselves. And this cannot last forever. So what kind of existence you want for yourself? You cannot live as a soldier for 1,000 years. You cannot. Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't be stronger than the Romans. So I'm trying to give a new theory for the Arab-Israeli conflict, based on my experience in the United States and my study of anthropology, because, you know, anthropology gives you the opportunity to look at other cultures. The best solution is that you have one state where people can learn and they can develop a culture of tolerance and coexistence. But this is right now is far away, because the Israelis feel that they are the stronger in the equation, and they are supported by the Americans. But I think that such support is not going to last forever. Look now at the American experience in Iraq. Now they want to go out, and they need the support of the Arabs to go out. So now the Arabs, they may have a card to put pressure on the United States, to put pressure on Israel. I mean, the mere interests of the United States one day will collide with the Israeli interest, and the United States will find itself in a situation where they have to put pressure on Israel to concede, to give something.
That was Sami Hammoudeh speaking in November of 2006 in his home in Ramallah in the West Bank.
باسم الشعب العربي باسم الشعب العربي يا من آمنتم بالمبدأ لا نساوم على حريتنا.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, executive producer, Khan Pham, associate director, Elena Botkin-Levy, production coordinator, and Keisha Thomas and Asma Mousseini, interns. And I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.